This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little last season Prada she's a me, honey.
John Callier, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curve?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now, you broke my mouth.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are celebrating the theatrical release of Call Me By Your Name, the new film from Luca Guadagnino. Empire Magazine called it deeply affecting. The New York Times called it a cinematic ravishment, and we're calling it a new queer classic, as beautifully melancholy as First Love itself.
So Daniel, does that mean I get to call you Alan, the whole show?
Oh, is that like a call me by your name joke? Yeah.
Yes. Did you not get that?
I got it.
So I call you Alan and you call me Daniel.
I will think about that.
The reason why I say that is because that's just an interesting aspect in this film.
It is.
As to why they want to call each other by
It's a little
name.
Bit strange as well, because the film plays with identity in so many ways, and with naming things and with not naming things.
Yeah.
So I think it's so interesting that the film, like the book, is called Call Me By Your Name. But we'll flesh that out tonight. We do have a star-studded lineup to celebrate the theatrical release of Call Me By Your Name this evening. Our first guest is Andre Assaman, the awarded writer of Call Me By Your Name. And what an intellect, what a fellow. And we'll also be revisiting our chat with Call Me By Your Name director and auteur Luca Guadagnino. He's known for works like A Bigger Splash and I Am Love. Mm. But Alan, I think this is his masterpiece.
You should call me Daniel, Alan. And I do love it when you're right, Alan. It does make me happy inside.
Yeah.
But definitely Luca Guadagnino, fantastic filmmaker, two great films.
He's got a full
so fantastic, and A Bigger Splash, and now Call Me By Your Name. I mean,
well, also other works of his, Melissa P, for instance, which was one of the first films of his that I was introduced to. We see him starting to develop these themes that he revisits in all of these films, the idea of family,
yes,
and the idea of kind of that the middle class, so to speak, and also extravagance and opulence. And he kind of builds on these themes with each of his new films. And I really think this film is where all of those themes are just so finely balanced. They are. This is a masterpiece.
Mr. Perlman. Thank you so much.
So nice. Très confiant.
I can show you around.
That'd be great. Thank you. So what do you do around here?
Read books, transcribe music, swim at the river, go out at night.
Sounds fun. All right, later.
Just watch. This is how we'll say goodbye to us when the time comes. Later.
Meanwhile, we'll have to put up with him for 6 long weeks.
Muscles are firm. Not a straight body in these statues. They're all curved. Sometimes impossibly curved, and so nonchalant, hence their ageless ambiguity, as if they're daring you to desire them.
Oh, to see without my eyes the first time that you kiss.
Is there anything you don't know?
Boundless by the time I cry.
you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what things.
You saying what I think you're saying?
Shouldn't have said anything.
Just pretend you never did.
Nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spot.
Call me by your name and I'll call you by mine.
Doesn't it make the hairs stand up on the back of your neck? I mean, that trailer gives me goosebumps. Mm. This film, it is, you know, it's not often I rave about a film, but we saw this together at MIFF in, I think it was August.
That's right.
And I have not stopped thinking about this film since.
Definitely. And I'm not sure if we're going to be terribly critical tonight because both of us are in danger of gushing about this film. Wouldn't you agree? I'm gushing.
I'm calling it the best film of the year and a new queer classic. So if that's not gushing.
Yeah, I'm with you on that 100%. And this is my favorite queer film of all time.
We're in good company. Entertainment Weekly called it a knockout. The Village Voice called it spellbinding. Esquire called it a masterwork. The Hollywood Reporter called it sublime. Verge called it a classic. I mean,
look.
If these aren't superlatives flying around the room.
Without a doubt. But you know what? Not everyone is gushing, Daniel. You know, the reviewer at The New Yorker calls this film, he describes it the empty, sanitized intimacy of Call Me By Your Name. He says that the mental lives of the characters in this film are thin and empty. They're sluggish. And the pace of the action just results in an enervating emptiness.
So you found one negative review.
Yeah, out of many. But, you know, and I was offended. I was reading that review and absolutely offended. I thought, how dare you? Obviously went to a different film. And I did a different cut, different direction.
I don't know how to respond to that. I feel like these characters are so complex, and their yearnings and internal desires, and true selves are so complicated and yet kind of portrayed in such accessible fashion for us. You know, we can't not hang on every word and every action because, you know, it's not just like there's so much unsaid in this film.
Precisely. It was about the unsaid, the unspoken word, the non-verbal, and I think that's what we really connected with. This reviewer here was complaining that there was not enough of that exploration.
I strongly disagree.
Of dialogue. And, you know, it was completely irrelevant. He missed the point.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, what's this film really about?
Well, Andre Aciman and Luca Guadagnino both say that this is a film and a story about desire. I think it is that, but I also think this is a story about love, about young love, about first love, and about how bittersweet and melancholy and beautifully tragic young love really is. That's what this is a story about. And, you know, I don't recall the last time I sat in a film and felt so strongly that yearning for my youth.
Yeah.
That's what this film did to me.
And it was also long ago, wasn't it, Daniel?
It was like yesterday.
It was like yesterday for you, unlike the rest of us in the audience.
I mean, it's not often that a film makes you want to be 17 again.
Oh God, it's so nostalgic in that sense, you know, that poignant yearning for the past. I mean, it does. It's a true arrow right through the heart in that sense.
Oh, look, this is a film that everyone has to go and see. Mm. And so we're thrilled tonight to be giving away a double pass to this new masterpiece from Luca Guadagnino.
That's right. And we want you to text in and let us know that if you had the opportunity of creating a film of your first love, what would you call it? What title would you give for the film of your first love?
What title would you give, Alan?
Well, the title for mine would be Torment.
Okay.
The teenage tale of frustration and unrequited love where the boy does not get the boy. So sad. But, you know, that's it. Torment for me. What about you, Danny?
The disappointment.
We're both on the same page.
I'm not going to say anything. I was going to link back to the film, but I don't want to give anything away about how the story kind of unfolds. Mm-hmm. But this is so... So it captures young love so authentically, doesn't it?
It does. So I'm guessing, Daniel, you didn't have a summer fling in Italy.
Oh my God! If only there was a summer fling in Italy. Mm. We have already had a message in the messenger asks, "What film are you talking about?" The film we are talking about is Call Me by Your Name. It's the new masterpiece from Luca Guadagnino, which opens nationally. It opens nationally. Yes.
Yeah, on the 26th of December.
Next week.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. Boxing Day next week.
Oh God, it's next week. I keep on thinking.
We are Christmas celebrating this film this evening. Coming up, after this, we're speaking with Andre Assaman, the, writer of this novel, which was turned into, this beautiful new film. We're also revisiting our chat with Luca Guadagnino, the director of this film. You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Is there anything you don't know?
I know nothing, Oliver.
Well, you seem to know more than anybody else around here.
Well, if you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what, thanks.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I thought you should know.
Because you thought I should know?
Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know.
You are listening to Outtakes, and that was a clip from Call Me By Your Name. It's the new film from Luca Guadagnino, starring, as you heard there, Armie Hammer and Timothy Chalamet. And we are celebrating this film on Outtakes this evening. What a beautiful film.
Absolutely beautiful film. And I think you were saying that this is a story about seduction, about desire.
It's about desire, but it is about love too.
And about love. But I think also too, what we've got here is what I really liked about this film was this real game of cat and mouse of Mexican standoff as to, you know, who's going to really make that first move? Who's going to declare their desire
first? Because you know what?
That jockeying for position.
It builds tension.
It does.
We were all sitting on the edges of our seats waiting to see what happened. And there were no tawdry sex scenes. This was not a film about debauched film. This was not debauched filmmaking. Building tension by actually making us care for the characters and actually bringing us into their world.
Without a doubt. And I think that the trailer that you just played, Daniel, it was where Timothy Chalamet, who plays Elio, really does make the first move. He really is declaring himself in a subtle way. But Oliver, played by Armie Hammer, he gets it. And you actually see them sort of circle around this monument in the town square until they finally
there's this kind of to-ing and fro-ing throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
Now we have asked our listeners to message in. We do have a double pass to give away to Call Me By Your Name. This is a must-see film and it opens next week.
Yep.
So message in, let us know, have you seen the film? Did you see it at MIFF? If you did, what did you think? Mm-hmm. Do you know Luca Guadagnino's work? Are you familiar with it? Do you like it? And if you haven't, message in and let us know what your first love would be called if it were made into a movie. And we've had some messages in, Alan.
Yes, we have. First of all, we've had a Joy membership, a renewal. Thank you very much.
From Gary in Singapore.
Gary from Singapore. We've also heard from Gina. Gina said that she's a lesbian, also gushing. It was a beautiful and delicious film, and she gives us much love. And she's on the way home from the hospital with little Harper. So congratulations to Gina, a new mother.
Speaking of young love.
Can't wait to celebrate Mother's Day with her next year.
We have also gotten a message in from Richard in Caulfield who says, my title already exists, High School Musical. And Richard says, sounds like Call Me By Your Name is a must for Boxing Day. Thank you, Richard.
And we've also had a message in from Jeff at Mill Park, and he says, what a great show. well done, lads. My movie would be Love in the Oort Cloud, an interstellar romance. Oh, wow. So it's out of this world. Sounds great.
That is
great.
A movie that I would go and see. I love it. Thank you, Jeff.
Isn't the Oort Cloud very rocky, though, full of asteroids? Is that what he's alluding to?
I don't know.
Smashed apart, broken
to
pieces.
You have to go and see the film.
Don't know.
We have had another message. Hi, Outtakes team. I read this book and fell in love. Please, can I have 2 tickets? I will call a film about my young life, Memoir of Young Love. It's from Chum.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Very aptly titled. So thank you. Keep those messages coming. If you want to go in the running to take this double pass to Call Me By Your Name, the new master work from Luca Guadagnino, message in on 0427JOY949.
Or email us on air@joy.org.au.
It's hard to know what to say about this film. I think it's kind of, in a way, captures where we are today in relation to queerness, mm-hmm, and in relation to sexuality.
Yep.
Because it's so interesting that a film with a title like Call Me By Your Name should actually never seek to name the love that it depicts. Mm-hmm. We don't hear the word gay. We don't hear the word queer. We don't hear the word bisexual. Sure. Alan, you were trying to convince me before that Elio and Oliver were bisexual.
Well, I think the movie does hint at that, and there is some exploration of them both experiencing.
Well, they both have
relations with women and also sex with women.
But the film never uses any kind of category to define their sexuality. No. Their sexualities are just portrayed as fluid.
Mm-hmm. And incidental. Almost irrelevant.
Yeah. This is a film about...
The fact of their sexuality doesn't matter. It is about love. It is about desire.
And
what's also great about it is that there is no recriminations. There's no antagonism from society in this sense. This is what I found so refreshing about this film was that we didn't have to go through that usual experience that we see in gay film and queer film of some societal pushback.
I'm going to put you on the spot here,
okay,
Alan.
Okay.
Do you think that the reason why the romance in this film is not defined, it's not called gay, it's not called queer, it's not called bisexual, do you think that's because this is based on a novel written by a straight man?
Well, I did not think for a moment that Andre Aciman was straight. Because if that's the case, then he seems to have a very queer leaning in his books, because I've been reading his most current novel, which is The Enigma Variations, and there's a very strong homoerotic influence in that. So I'm quite surprised. I'm surprised. You're blowing me away. So I really don't have an answer for that.
Well, I sat down with Andre earlier this week and had a chat with him about the novel and about the film. And, of course, I started by asking why it was that he had written this novel. And there's been a lot written about the fact that he'd just finished his first novel at the time, mm-hmm, and had quite a tough time putting that novel together, as most people do when they're writing their first novel. And then he just wrote this one in a few months. But I wanted to know what thematically, what it was that made him put these ideas on paper. This is what he had to say.
We were going to be taking a trip to Italy. And that year, it turned out, at the last minute, we discovered that we were not going to be able to go to Italy. And so I went, to bed that night feeling okay, fine, I'll put up with staying in New York. But in the morning, I woke up and I really had this vision of a wonderful house that was painted by Monet, and of a pine alley that led to the house, and of a beach nearby. And I think it was my subconscious trying to placate myself or giving me an out, an imaginary out of this box on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I just started writing about a house, a pine alley. And, of course, I had a car come in. And then out of this car comes out a young man. And I think what I did is that I went back to my very sort of early teens, when I was intrigued by a young man who happened to be Jewish in Alexandria, Egypt. And I think that is the character of sort of a proto-Oliver. And from there, I began to write a romance, which I had absolutely no idea I was doing. So the novel basically flourished out of this imaginary trip to Italy.
Amazing. And if there was, let's say, some kind of real-life Oliver somewhere in your distant past, were you the real-life Elio?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, to be honest, I think I am four characters in this book. I'm Elio, of course, because it's all written from his perspective. But I'm also Oliver, and I'm also this character of the poet who doesn't show up in the film, but is in the novel. Mm. And there's finally the father. I'm the father also, because by the time I was writing this book, I was a father to three sons. And I think I kind of sort of ambled between one and the other, between all four of them, so that I really had no fixed identity.
You know, I do want to come to this character of the father, who is the most incredible character and translated so well from the page to the screen. And I know that a lot of particularly gay people have reached out to you and say this is the father they never had but always wanted. Yeah. Do you anticipate that if you're child should come to you, let's say, when I don't know how old your children are, but when they're 17, do you anticipate that you would have the same kind of empathy and compassion and understanding that this father has?
I think so. I mean, I had a father like that, and I want to be a father like this, and I think it's not that difficult. I mean, for God's sake, if you like your child and you love your child, you know, what are you going to do? Banish them? Is this what one does? Absolutely not. You want them to basically to experience life at its fullest. And I think that that's the best advice any person can give a young person. You know, experience it. Don't hide from it. If you have this inclination, follow it. If you're suffering, don't smother the suffering because it's embarrassing to suffer. Just feel it. And if you love someone, then just do it.
Wow. I think that's what's resonated with so many people. This story completely avoids so many tropes that crop up again and again in queer literature and in queer film.
And I know.
There are no real, I don't think, antagonists in this story. The only antagonist is the desire itself, which is not really an antagonist. It's just what's kind of grappled with in this story. And there's no parental rejection either. The parents are on side. So was that a conscious decision that you made to kind of steer away from all of those tropes?
It wasn't conscious, but I realized as I was writing that I was making certain decisions. For example, there was a moment when I was actually fabricating this story where I thought that maybe it would be easier on all of us if we could have Oliver die in an accident. This way, the two may not necessarily consummate their love. And I said, no, they have to consummate it. Mm. And all along, there were little sort of buffers and hurdles that would crop up, and I would automatically kind of brush them aside without paying any heed to them, because I thought, you know, I'm not interested in I never use the word gay, and I never use the word love either. Mm. I didn't want to use anything that felt solid and sort of bituminous or ridiculously hard. I wanted everything to be soft and at the same time very mobile and what's the word I'm looking for? It's sort of shapeless, because I do love an emotion that is shapeless, that you cannot quite concretize even in words. And, you know, writers think that they always want to name things. Mm. Actually, it's when you avoid naming the obvious, because it's never that obvious, that you really end up having to really develop your own craft, because you're trying to work inward into something.
It's interesting how we talked about so many elements there of identity when you actually look at Andre himself. I mean, he was born in Egypt. They moved to France. They moved to Italy. They moved to America. He's also Jewish. So just in his own sort of person, he's been all of these. And I'm not surprised that this sort of comes up you know, comes out in Call Me By Your Name and also in the rest of his work.
It's a fascinating contradiction because on the one hand, we do have this play with identity. But on the other hand, as Andre was saying, he does play with the soft and the mobile and the shapeless. Mm. This film is all about things which cannot be named,
yep.
notwithstanding the fact that the film is called Call Me By Your Name. It's just the most wonderful contradiction. And what it does here is set the framework for a really beautiful coming of age story that is so real and authentic.
Would you call it a coming of age film, or would you call it an awakening? I know that, you know, we've talked about coming of age films in the past, Daniel, where we say that, you know, part of that journey of coming of age is actually to make really poor decisions and to find yourself, find yourself in really challenging situations that you may regret in future life.
As beautiful as this story is.
Yes.
I don't think that you could categorically say that this was the best decision Elio ever embarked, the protagonist. You know, his decision to seek a relationship with Oliver is double-edged. There's no doubt. You know, this is not...
In that he knew that his heart would be broken, that he would be left desolate.
Well, that's the lesson of young love, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Threw caution to the wind and went for it anyway.
Seized the moment. Yes. And I think that has a lot to do as well with why this film stirs such feelings of nostalgia.
See, for me, Daniel, I think this was an awakening to the human condition. Really, that's what I think this is. He actually woke up. This is an awakening for Elio. And as a result, he became truly adult.
But is that not what coming of age is? I mean, they're really one and the same thing. And that's why, you know, we haven't touched on it yet. We might come to it later, but that's why there's an interesting play here with fruit and this very kind of Edenic idea that, you know, you pluck the fruit from the tree and suddenly you're awake to the realities of the world.
That's right. Right, what is it? The tree of knowledge, is that
yes? Or tree of life?
Tree of life. Okay,
one of them. There were two.
Along those lines, anyway, Jamie.
You are listening to Outtakes, where we are celebrating Call Me By Your Name more with the author of this fantastic story, Andre Assaman. Right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are celebrating the theatrical release of Luca Guadagnino's new masterpiece, Call Me By Your Name.
Professor Perlman.
Welcome. So what do you do around here?
Read books, swim at the river, go out at night.
That sounds fun. All to see
without my eyes. Shouldn't have said anything.
Just pretend you never did. That you kiss me.
Nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spot.
Call Me By Your Name, rated R.
And Daniel, you got to interview Andre Assaman, who's the author of the book Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, and what an intellect.
Oh, definitely. So sharp, so intelligent, I guess. Erudite is probably the best word. And let's hear more from Andre, shall we?
I want to play my hand at this stage. One of the things that I just adore about this text and about the film that it inspired is the sense of nostalgia that it engenders. I mean, that was the overall... Yeah. I don't think I've ever quite had the experience of wishing to be 17 again because, you know, those were rocky years, but there was something about this story that incited that in me. And I wonder if it is, as you say, the kind of shapelessness that you were working towards, because in a way that is the shape of nostalgia.
Well, that's a good point you're making. I've asked a lot of people why they start crying at the film.
Mm.
And most people don't know why. I mean, that's the point, is that there's a moment in the film when they catch themselves tearing up and sobbing. And I basically decided that the fundamental thing about nostalgia is not that you want to go back to when you were 17, but that you wish you could go back to 17 with the knowledge of what you really have become since. Mm-hmm. In other words, what if when at the age of 17, rather than stifle your own sexuality, you were allowed to let it blossom? What if at that age you were not ashamed and not fearful? At that point, I think you understand that nostalgia, the painful part of this whole thing, which is also a form of enchantment, by the way, which is positive, the painful part is that you realize that what you're lamenting is what you never had.
Yes.
Most of us at the age of 17 didn't know much, much less had we done much. I don't think so. Some people just kind of sailed along painfully because it wasn't happening the way that their body was asking them to let things happen.
There's a sense of longing as well, which I think is what you're describing too, and somehow heightened by the longing that the characters in this story have as well, because Elio and Oliver I would describe as deeply longing characters too. And so yeah. I think that kind of feeds into the nostalgia that we then feel watching this film and reading this story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I don't know what happened to us once we turned, say, 25, 26, 27, but something changed, I think, and it's partly knowledge, partly acceptance. Mm. At the age of 17, we probably weren't accepting who we were.
The experience of adolescence is thematically quite similar to the experience. This is something we've talked a lot about here on Outtakes, but thematically quite similar to the experience of coming out, because it's all about kind of wrestling with yourself. And I think that's another reason why this is not a coming out story, but I think it's a reason why it resonates so deeply in the gay or the queer psyche, because the themes that you're exploring in this text related to that kind of gritty no man's terrain that we're in when we're 17 is so familiar to queer audiences.
I totally agree. It's because you had to, I mean, there is a template and you found yourself not fitting in the template, and therefore you battled with yourself and you didn't even know what you were doing, and you were questioning and sometimes not even questioning, and all this, and you were projecting images, constantly projecting images. And part of what I call nostalgia is basically retrieving images that were never concretized, that were never realized. And that's very painful. That's very saddening sometimes. It's not crushingly saddening, but it makes you sad because you realize that something happened back then that you overcame in many ways, but at the same time, you stayed at that level for the rest of your life.
I don't know. You say it's not crushing, but there is something I found to be crushing about this story, and I think that's because of how melancholy it is and how beautiful it is. I mean this with the utmost respect, but it's a weight, you know. I carried the story around with me for so long because of how beautiful it was.
Well, the beauty, I don't think the beauty sort of blandifies it. It is sad and beautiful and enchanting at the same time.
And deeply erotic, too.
Oh, I'm sure. I would love to think so.
Well, I was reading, actually, that you'd said elsewhere you had gotten letters from people telling you that they'd be reading the story on the train with an erection.
Oh, yeah.
So I found it deeply erotic.
Well, I yes. And, I mean, it was really strange because on one day I get a letter saying, an email saying, I'm crying in the subway and I'm embarrassed. And the next day, exactly the next day, I get this one and I'm trying to contain my erection.
But I think that shows how the story resonates so differently but deeply with so many different people in so many different ways.
You cannot, and I've always wanted this to be a fact that is undeniable, which is why I think the book is so true, is that it fundamentally recognizes the power of the body.
Yes.
And the body and skin and orifices are never out of the picture. They're always there.
Yes.
Because ultimately we are beholden to nothing else, if to nothing else, than to our bodies.
It's so interesting, though, because at the same time as there is definitely that kind of grappling with the carnal in this novel, there is also, you know, Elio and Oliver, for instance, form some kind of kinship over their Jewishness, so over these kind of non-corporal identity markers. And I wonder, you know, this is again something that we've looked at on the program before, this idea that Jewishness and queerness are very similar in many ways, because both identities experience that kind of almost paralyzing sense of otherness.
Well, and hiddenness.
Yes.
Don't forget that a Jew hides his identity. And of course, it's Marcel Proust who recognized that there is a fundamental bond between the two because they both behave in exactly the same way. One Jew picks out another Jew in a crowd the same way as a person gifted with gaydar picks up another gay person in a crowd, okay? There's an instant sort of recognition of consanguinity, as it were.
Yes.
But the Jewishness was important for me because it established from the very beginning the fact that there was something that they both shared in common. And it made the rest possibly happen precisely because they had this one thing in common. They may have had nothing else in common, but they had one thing, and on the strength of this one thing, they built a relationship.
I could talk with you about it endlessly, but I'm conscious of the fact that we are running out of time. So I do want to ask, when Luca Guadagnino came to Australia with the film, when it premiered here in Australia, he did a Q&A at the end of the film, and somebody stood up and started talking to him about the fact that he really has isolated the story to a particular point in time, whereas, of course, your novel doesn't do that. And Luca made some flippant joke about, well, maybe one day there'll be a sequel. And I wondered, as somebody who adores the film, what your thoughts are on the possibility of a sequel.
Well, the novel basically is half the film.
Exactly.
The rest of the novel takes place in the years that come after.
Yeah.
5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years. So there's lots of material that can be focused on. Luca has spoken to me about a possible sequel, and he plays around with the idea, but I don't think he wants to do it right away. He's thinking of it in the few years because he wants to see Army and Timothy sort of grow older a bit.
All right. Well, that's a good taster, I think, to leave our listeners with. It has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for putting aside the time to speak with us, and thank you so much for your beautiful words.
Oh, thank you. Thank you again.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9.
And that was The Mystery of Love by Sufjan Stevens.
Which features in the new masterpiece from Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name, which we've been spotlighting this evening. And it is a masterpiece. I mean, it's got my bet to win the Oscar next year for Best Film. I'd be surprised if we don't have the cast and indeed Luca nominated for their own Oscars.
Well, fingers crossed, they've already had three Golden Globe nominations for Best Picture, Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor.
Don't get me started on the Luca snub, though. I mean, I cannot explain that. I think the direction in this film is so fantastic and really Luca at the height of his game.
Yeah, it's superb. I think because what you actually sense here in this film, there's so much that's left unsaid, but you feel it.
Well,
you can touch it. You can smell it. I mean, it's very sensual and sensuous.
Well, that's what Andre, the writer of Call Me By Your Name, who we were just speaking with, described this sense of shapelessness that he wanted to evoke in the story. And I think he does.
There is definitely an amorphous characteristic to the film in that sense, without a doubt. I mean,
because that's what emotions are. They're amorphous. And I think Andre's point is that it's a travesty when you actually try and put a name, which is ironic again in the light of the name of the film, but you can't really put a name to, and maybe that's what You Call Me By Your Name, I'll Call You By Mine is about. It's about kind of undoing the authority of names, maybe. I don't know.
Well, you're just going way zipping
straight over my head there, Daniel.
No, look, there's no doubt that this is a must-see classic film. It is, I think we all agree, it is a new queer classic. So we have a double pass here to give away to Call Me By Your Name, which opens theatrically on Boxing Day next week.
Courtesy of Cinema Nova, our friends
at
Cinema Nova.
Thank you, Cinema Nova. And we've asked you to message in on 0427JOY949 or to email us at onair@joy.org.au.
And don't forget to tell us your membership number.
Absolutely.
Right?
Tell
us your membership. Anything in the last 7 days either.
And to tell us as well, you know, do you know Luca? Do you know his work? Have you seen the film? And if not, tell us what your first love, if it were a film, what it would be called.
And you know what? We've had a text in from Nick, and Nick tells us his My Young Love movie would be A Spanish Dream. Oh, it sounds exciting.
I want to see the tagline for that film. I don't know.
A Spanish Dream powered by Spanish Fly, which is the aphrodisiac. Anyway, maybe I'm just thinking a little bit too. I'm thinking Antonio Banderas, maybe, you know, from years ago. And
we have had another message in from Anonymous who says, holy moly, Luca Guadagnino is directing the Suspiria remake. Did you get to ask him about it? And James Ivory wrote the script. Did you ask him about that?
I don't know, Daniel. You got to meet Luca Guadagnino.
I had a chat in this very studio with Luca when it screened at MIFF, and I asked him about both of those things.
Oh, you did?
I did. Well, I didn't so much as ask him about Suspiria, but made him promise that he'd come back and do another interview when it was released. And I definitely did have a chat with him about dynamics of the script writing, because James Ivory is a prolific filmmaker and script writer. Oh,
definitely. The Merchant Ivory films, Morris, A Room with a View, yeah. Passage to India.
And I think there's a really interesting dynamic between their two perspectives, their artistic perspectives. But there was also a lot of politics that we're not going to go into this evening, but we did discuss it when we did our Melbourne International Film Festival program. And there's a podcast of that program at joy.org.au/outtakes.
Daniel, you're shameless. You never miss an opportunity to plug our podcast.
You can also access Outtakes podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Did you know that, Alan?
Yes, I did, because I do podcast our shows. Do you know that? I do.
Well, we did, as you said, we did have a chance to sit down with Luca when the film screened here in Melbourne for the first time at the Melbourne International Film Festival.
I retrospectively realized that maybe I keep going back to the same terrains, but it's something that I don't decide in cold blood. I think I'm more interested in trying to find explorative occasions. Like in this movie, I was more, something that drove me to make it was more about portraying the Pianura Padana, which is the region in which the movie is set.
Mm.
That was the driving force.
The region always plays a very important role in your films.
Oh yeah, I think landscape is so important.
Yeah.
Not landscape in the sense of the postcard. I mean the landscape, the emotional landscape for the characters.
It sounds like you're a fairly intuitive filmmaker.
I like him. I like to hinge on intuition. I think it's important. I think... because we are in an LGBTQI, QQ, whatever, radio, I think it's important to say that intuition is the door that may open someone to cross a path to something they can't predict and preordain into a box, whether it's identity, gender, artistic influence. And I think a lot of decisions that we don't make by intuition, but we make by logic or even by applying some sort of intelligence to it that is a rational intelligence, may be the outcome of, again, something edited, something acted out on us. And that's why I endorse intuition as a way to discover in within yourself things that you may not thought of yourself. And that's why it's important in this specific place where we are that of all the words that have to be embraced, that the word queer is the most important because it's the one that drives us toward the path of the unclassifiable.
Yes.
And in this way, I believe that my intuition is also my queerness.
Fantastic. It actually resonates with something that you said when we spoke to you last year, which is that making a film is an act of truthfulness and that you always want your films to be truthful.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't sound and come up pompously. I hate pompousness, like, and saying I hate pompousness, I sound pompous. But truthfully, it's really, I think it's... I think that the idea that making film has to do with the effort in sounding clever, the effort in looking clever, I think it's quite boring and cynical. I much rather prefer to think of making films as an act of openness.
If I can come back to this word queer, would you call Me By Your Name a queer film?
As far as I would call a Fritz Lang or a Alfred Hitchcock or a Maurice Pialat movie a queer movie, I think it's queer not by its thematics. It's queer by its attitude.
I feel like really all of your films have a kind of queer a sensibility.
Anarchic, probably, yes.
Are you comfortable with me classifying your films in that way or thinking about your films in that way?
As far as they are not classified that way by the Anglo-Saxon in the box categories in which because the director is a gay man, then the movie are queer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that is one of the greatest disappointment of the otherwise pivotal civil rights advancement.
Yeah.
That... we started by trying to be, being able to slip through all the cracks and all the layers and all the holes and every places in without being classifiable.
Yeah.
And we are ending up putting ourselves into
in boxes.
Boxes and holes that are narrow and narrowing. So yeah.
Oftentimes people do classify films by the sexuality of the people making the films or in the films. And I think that is limiting.
That's a travesty.
I think the best queer cinema is queer cinema that feels queer, that somehow resonates in the queer consciousness.
I would say the best cinema ever has that sensibility.
Yeah.
How can you define a movie like Vertigo, Alfred Hitchcock masterpiece, if not queer? It's about a man who is obsessed with a woman that he lost to the degree that when he sees meets another woman who looks like her, he makes her become the other woman. That's quite fantastic, and it's so queer. Or if you think of a novel by Ernest Hemingway, the most macho writer of every canon from American literature of the 20th century, the Old Man and the Sea.
Yeah.
How queer is a novel about that?
Absolutely. And again, this ties into what we were talking about last time, because we were talking about some of your influences. We were talking about Jonathan Demme. We were talking about Thomas Mann and Klaus Mann. Even the texts that we were talking about last time, the kind of Mannian texts, they are very queer and in many ways thematically similar to your work.
I mean, we know that I'm influenced very strongly by Thomas Mann, by the way, and also Klaus Mann. But I don't see a middle ground for being an artist. I don't see something reasonable about it. I think something excessive. I see something that goes into really deep directions of crossover.
Yeah.
And I am a little bit saddened when I realize that many people who works in the arts, particularly many of the successful ones, in a way they are aiming for an ordinary life that spills over in their art, in their work, in their art.
That was our chat with Luca Guadagnino, the director of Call Me By Your Name, which we are calling a new queer classic and which opens next week. I do just want to say that that is part of a much longer chat that we had with Luca when the film premiered here in Melbourne. And we picked that part because I think that it really gives us a really good idea of his artistic sensibilities. But if you do want to hear Luca talking more about the film, by all means, head to joy.org.au/outtakes and you can catch the whole interview there.
You can. That was a fantastic interview, Daniel. In particular, I really like that, Alan. I think it's a good interview is a combination of the interviewer and the interviewee, and you did very well. But I think what I was really interested there was your discussion around queerness. And I really liked Luca's explanation of where his queerness comes from. He said his intuition is his queerness.
Mm.
And I heavily correlate intuition with creativity.
Mm.
And so in this sense, you know, what Luca is really telling me that his intuition, his creativity is his queerness. And as a result, really that imbues his films, because if he's in order to create these films, he must be intuitive. He must be creative.
And it's many-layered as well. Because in this film, Elio and Oliver, and indeed the father brought so brilliantly to life by Michael Stuhlbarg, they're all intellects, they're all creatives, they're all academics. So I think that Luca was really able to give voice to his own sensibilities through these characters.
Ooh, that's a very interesting read on that.
We did have a listener ask us about the writing, and yes, James Ivory is credited, but Luca did write a substantial proportion of this script.
But we
have been giving away a double pass.
We have been giving away a double pass to see the film Call Me By Your Name, courtesy of Cinema Nova. And we asked you, the listener, to text in and let us know that if your first love would be created as a film, what would you call it? And so we received a message in from Jeff at Mill Park, who gets to win the prize, because he said that his movie would be called Love in the Oort Cloud, a stellar interstellar romance. Well, I thought that was pretty
cool. Jeff, we will be in touch shortly to discuss your double pass. But look, that's it for another week of Outtakes. We do, of course, need to thank Andre Asserman for joining us on Outtakes this evening, as well as Sony for organising that interview for us. And also a big thanks to Luca for joining us back in August. But catch the film. It's a must-see film. Call Me By Your Name. It opens nationally next week. That's it for another week of Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.